Hi, everybody. This is Marisa Espinosa. She, her pronouns, and I'll call this meeting to order. Nikki, I'm sorry. I just realized I don't know if I have the most up-to-date list of people on the committee. So I'm wondering if I should be referring to that when I do the roll call. I apologize.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I did email you an up-to-date list. If you can check, otherwise, I'm happy to just move forward with my list, Marisa.
Okay. Is that just now that you sent that, or sorry?
This afternoon. That's okay. How about I just move forward with it?
Sure.
No problem. Okay. So as I call, if you guys can please unmute and indicate that you are present. We'll start with Ashley Miller.
Present.
Hi, Ashley.
Hello.
Rachel Nessie.
Present.
Taylor Smiley Wolf.
Present.
Ada Antonio. Ada, Alan Lazo.
Present.
Hi, Alan. Barbara Geyer.
Present.
Becky Strauss. Young Ho.
Hello, present.
Hi, Young. Ellen Tolan.
I'm present. Hi.
Hi, Ellen. Holly Stevens. Jay Rutherford.
Present.
Jay. Mara Romero. We're today. Marisa.
Present.
Thank you, Marisa. Vera Warren. And Fanny Adams.
Present.
Okay. All right, great. So we did hit quorum. Welcome to the August Fair Housing Advocacy Committee meeting. Thank you. And Marisa did call us to order. So I will just go ahead and move us on to some staff updates today. It's good to see you guys. So first off, I'll address that the meeting looks a little bit different today, and I am on camera in this conference room, and I know can't quite see my face as well, and I have a couple PHP colleagues here with me, Uma and Bumal, that we'll hear from later. The Portland Housing Bureau has officially opened back up to the public to attend in person our public meetings, and that includes APAC committee meetings. So you may have noted in Ryan's email when he sent out the agenda that you are welcome to come down to the Portland Housing Bureau and attend APAC meetings in person if you would like. If you're more comfortable or it works easier for you to continue to attend virtually, that will remain an option. So thanks for having patience with us while we're in this new hybrid environment, but this is how we will be proceeding moving forward. And that means that public testimony may also be in person. Folks from the community can come in and sign up and give public testimony from our offices for greater accessibility, or they can also still do so via Zoom as they have in the past. My next update is just regarding that Meet the Committee page that we talked about on our Bureau website. So in our last meeting, which was actually in April, we were asked to send in headshots and bios. So I wanted to say thank you to everyone that took the time to do that. I really appreciate it. If you haven't taken a look at the published final page, I just dropped it in the chat for you. And if you haven't had a moment to send those in, if you could get those to me by the end of the week and I can make sure that everyone is included, that would be wonderful. Also from the last meeting, you may remember that our appointment terms for committee members end next month in September. So I did ask everybody and check in one-on-one to see who would be moving forward with reappointments and who may be just finishing out their term with us next month. We do have three committee members that will be finishing their term with us, and that means that this is actually their last meeting. So I'm going to announce their names in a moment. But before I do, I'd ask that you please unmute and we can just give a small round of applause for our fellow community members and thank them for the time that they've served with us over the last 2 years. Our first committee member is Ada Antonio. She's not here today, but I'll go ahead and give a little clap for Ada. Thank you. Becky Strauss, who also is not here, but I'll give a clap for Becky. Becky. And finally, our chair, Marisa Espinoza. Thank you so much, Marisa. Really appreciate it. I personally very thankful for your time spending with the committee and for your leadership in particular, Marisa, in taking on the chair position. So thank you. And in that vein, the Rental Services Office has been working on recruitment in order to fill those positions. Thank you to each committee member that took time to share those postings with your networks. We were able to have a total of 16 applicants for our 3 available seats. We are finalizing our recommendations, and then once everything is confirmed, I'll send out an update email to share with all of you where we're at on that. But we anticipate that they will be formally appointed next month, along with all the other committee members scheduled for reappointment. So in September, I'll send out council information as soon as I have it. And that is all the staff updates that I have. Thank you. The next item on our agenda for today's meeting is our demographic summary. This is the very first section of our Portland Fair Housing Plan. And the 2 lead presenters will be Uma Krishnan, sitting with me here at PHB, as well as Bimal Rajbhandari, who's on the other side of Uma here. And I will hand it off to Uma to get us started on the presentation.
Okay, there you go. Oh, can you just drop the intro? Okay, there you go. Introduce yourself.
Oh, no. You probably cannot hear us, right? Good afternoon. She asked, as Nikki said, introduce ourselves. So I am Uma Krishnan. I do know some of you others. Perhaps we don't know each other. I'm with the Housing Bureau, the data team. And before that, for several years, I was the city's demographer with the Planning Bureau. So I take a particular passion with demography. So maybe I literally begged Nikki to let me present. So I'm gonna hand it to Bimal, who is my colleague with the data team at PHP.
Hi, my name is Bimal Rajbhandari. I've been here in front of the committee before. So for the last couple of years, and so I'm excited to be here again and hoping to have a restart of the whole, you know, the planning process. Thank you.
Thank you. So before we launch into the demographic summary, we just wanted to take a moment to outline the presentation for you and lay some context. This is the first part of the Portland Fair Housing Plan. We will cover the effort and how it relates and compares to the traditional analysis of impediments. Uma will speak to the impact and influence of population growth, composition, diversity, income, and poverty on housing opportunities. And then Bimal will spotlight some selected characteristics of Portland's households. So it has been a while since we have met. I wanted to take a moment to remind us all about the Portland Fair Housing Plan and about what led us to this work to start with. So remember back in 2020 and early 2021, we were looking originally at the 2011 analysis of impediments to fair housing choice. And that was the last time the comprehensive fair housing planning was done. This is consortium-wide, which means that it includes multiple different jurisdictions, Multnomah County, City of Portland, City of Gresham, all going through this process of fair housing planning together. It's also related to those other HUD required planning, and that is why we are waiting from HUD to give us more information.
Back up a slide for me. Sure, thank you.
And in the interim, this body has decided to move forward with the support of the Housing Bureau on a Portland Fair Housing Plan. It is different in that we are only looking at the Portland jurisdiction when we look at these areas of analysis. We will cover the topics as outlined in our project plan. If you recall the memo that each committee member, we did a presentation on, and everybody gave feedback to incorporate in that plan. And then we will expand upon this work whenever the analysis of impediments or any similar fair housing planning requirement is announced by HUD. And so this first section, the demographic analysis that we are entering into, is to set the context as we look at all of those other areas and policy recommendations moving forward. Thank you. And there's going to be just a few words that we hear within the AI, and we'll probably hear again as we move through the Portland Fair Housing Plan. So I wanted to take a moment to define those. When we talk about barriers and housing barriers in this context, it's any factor or condition that has the potential to create a disparate impact on a person's housing choice. That can be a variety of different things. When we talk about an impediment, that is a defined term, and it specifically means actions, omissions, or decisions by a jurisdiction that effectively restrict a person's housing choice because of race, color, religion, gender, disability, familial status, or national origin. So those do have different meanings, and we will hear them as we move through this work and as we compare it to the recommendations that were made in the analysis of impediments in 2011. So keep that in mind, and that all barriers we expect will limit housing choice, but some barriers become impediments when they are related to protected class status specifically, and actions, omissions, or decisions made by a jurisdiction. And with that, I will hand it over to Uma.
Thank you. I hope you all can hear me, and this is probably the loudest I can talk, but I really hope you can hear me. And before I explain this slide, I just wanted to, and because Nikki just talked about when we did the last plan, so that was in 2011, and most of that data came from the 2005-2009 ACS, the American Community Survey, and then it used some 2010 decennial data. 10 years have gone by, and a lot has happened, and including the fact that in 2020, the census did a full census as in counting everybody through their short form. And then they released their data last year in 2021. So even if, you know, the other, the full analysis of impediments is not due until this work probably need not start until 2024, it really makes sense for us to start looking at the 2020 census, because the city changes so quickly, right? And for most of you, and Nikki talks about this all the time, lived experience, and you do have a good idea where Portland stands, not just in terms of its housing or affordability issues or population growth, but these numbers kind of substantiate what perhaps we see on the ground. More people, more traffic, or reduced rental vacancy rates. So this work around Portland's Fair Housing Plan, it's a great opportunity for us to get grounded and form this base that, you know, this is 2022, but we did take a look at where we were in 2020. And so the slides I'm going to talk about, largely it's going to be about the population growth and the composition. And Bimal will cover really interesting slides around poverty and income and tenure. And we really hope that it's not just the two of us giving you a lot of numbers and then you get bored or you'll get overwhelmed. But the whole idea is at the end of this presentation, hopefully we'll have time left because we have only 10, 15 slides. But that you as a committee help us kind of better understand how these are barriers and what we could do in terms of planning to address some of these barriers which can potentially become impediments. So bringing us back to this slide, I wanted to put it up because it's fascinating, and I found this in the, it's an Atlas Portlandness, a cultural atlas. It came out at PSU, and it gives, if you look at the graphics, it shows how the city grew spatially, right? And it begins back in 1890s and goes all the way 94 to present. But it shows annexation. So 19th and 20th centuries, it was spatially expanding Portland. In 1845, it was just 36 blocks. At the early part of 1900, you know, neighborhoods like Montevilla, Linton, St. John's, they were all annexed. And there was limited annexation between 1950 and 80. And then there was a whole lot of annexation of East Portland between 1980 and 1998. The reason it's relevant to a Portland population growth conversation is because when you annex land, it also you know, brings in people, right? And many of them, they have already lived here, and we are just bringing them into the fold of the city's boundary so that we can do urban services provision or whatever that is, which is somewhat different from migration. So the next chart that you have, that you see, this is about population, how the total number of people in the city kind of grew from 1890 all the way to 2020. And it's really clear, like, right, we continued to grow, and there was rarely maybe one or two periods of decline. But then if you come to the moment you come to since 1990 and 2000, the slope of that regression line, it just steeply goes up. That means the rate of growth, by no means it's exponential or anything, but it's very steep, it's fast. And more people just means, right, we need to house them. So the city actually grew, not a surprise, we grew faster than the nation in the 21st century. And here is the important thing. Much of that growth since 2000, it's attributable to net migration as opposed to annexation. And this is interesting because when it's migration, this group of people who come, the new people who come into the city, they have different characteristics. Potentially, they could be different household type, size, educational attainment. And you can immediately realize, right, the last 10, 20 years, we have become a most educated city. I don't even know, is it just degree? I'm not sure. So that's what this population graph shows us. It clearly tells us that we have continued to grow, and since 2000, it is at a much faster pace than we did in the past. So this slide, it's largely focuses on the last 10 years. So in 2020, according to the census numbers, our population is 652,503. That's a pretty big number. You know, we have really, we have crossed the 500,000 and blown past it. And in the last 10 years, we added 69,000 people, and the percentage change is close to 12%. And to kind of put that 69,000 in some perspective, it means, you know, every year we could have potentially added, you know, if I was doing a cumulative averaging the annual growth rate, it's about, you know, 6,900 people, which is 18, 19 people every day. And right away we can tell, you know, we're getting people faster than we can build our homes. And to the, so that's the table you see that to the right kind of compares us to all the relative close by geography. You know, how do we compare to the nation as a whole? The nation grew at 7.4%, but we grew 12%. That's much higher rate. Oregon State, and we know we get a lot of the increase within the state. So the state grew at 10.6%, and the fact that we have a new congressional seat kind of tells us, yes, we did grow pretty fast pace. Seattle, actually, I personally, it was a surprise since the decade before this, they were not growing as fast. They grew at 21% and added like well over 120,000 people. And it could have been, I'm speaking from memory, but I think between 2000 and 2010, that was the first time Portland added more people than Seattle. And even probably you should go back and check, but I that's my recollection. And then the last 10 years have been so different. San Francisco, on the other hand, they grew, a little bit faster than the nation at 8.5%, added just about the same amount of, close to the number of people that we added. And for those of us kind of looking at people and housing, you know, we can kind of clearly relate these two things, that if Frisco doesn't have affordable housing, people have to move. And the migration is always from higher density to low. So Portland is well positioned to receive people from north and south. And we should look for people moving from Seattle. So this is, I have to confess, this is a graph I totally find fascinating, and I love this. And for those of you to whom it seems like really busy, these are called the population pyramid, where it allows us to look at the population of a city, but then by age and sex. So it tells us, you know, what is the composition of the city? You know, do we have a whole lot of old people, young people, people in the middle? So if you look at this is the pyramid from 2020. And the reassuring fact is because we have a stable base, it's a stable pyramid, but we are bulging in the middle, which is a good thing because that means we have a lot of people in the labor force. But I think you should also note that as we keep moving up and 65 and over, that is a sizable block as well. So this is a city that does have a significant number of older adults. And if we were to think about it in terms of what could be the potential barrier, which could be impediment, it's we really need accessible housing. And I know we have been talking about this for a long time, but the fact that we have at least 13, 14% of older adults in the city, we need to start thinking how well does the housing, available housing stock match that. So, I forgot, this I should have said right at the beginning when I put up this slide. So along the x-axis is the percentage of population, and each bar, like whether it's the blue or the pink, it kind of shows the share of that particular group where you see 0 to 4. So we have about 2.6 or 2.9, whatever that was, percent male young children. Likewise, on the other side, it's about 2.5 or 2.6. So all these, each of the single clustered bar, it's the share in the whole population. For this particular graph, in terms of composition, we have gender equality because we have almost same number of same share of men versus women. I think women are a little bit more at close to 50% or something. And if you start looking at charts from some of the other countries, even my own country, India, the sex ratio is actually in favor of men. So you can actually see it in the population pyramid, but we are in a good place. But the other thing to note is, say if I had put up a pyramid for Albania or Kenya or something, you would have seen a broad base, meaning a lot of young people, and then it tapers towards the top. That means not enough old people, and those countries have a certain set of problems which are very different from what we need to think about. By no means that would be balanced. If you took a look at the pyramid for Germany, you'll see a lot of, it's a huge top, but then the bottom narrows out. That means they don't have enough young people. But that's the value of these pyramids, that they help us understand, you know, the composition of the population, and which helps us plan for them. So this one, and there was some debate, but my friends here, Nikki to my right and Vimal to the left, they said leave it on. So it has two sets actually. You see 2020 and 2010. And when you put one pyramid on top of the other, it tells us, you know, which cohort grew or shrank. So you can tell, you know, the darker blue and the darker pink are recent numbers, and that share actually grew 1.6%. And the share of older adults, if you see 65 and above, they grew close to 2%. But then you'll also see a decline where you see the lighter blue kind of pointing out. That means in 2010, we had more children that age. So if you look at the group 0 to 17, that declined as a group 1.5%. And I know we are not here to talk about fertility trends and all that good stuff, but the fertility rate has dropped, and you see that in fewer children. So for demographers, it really makes sense. So we're done with the population growth and composition. So I have two more slides which just talk about the race and ethnicity, and these have come from the 2020 data. And you see about 2010 and then 2020, it's clear, right? In 2020, just over 72% of the population were white. Come 2020, that share has declined. And this is the first time there has been this significant drop of 6%. But that doesn't mean, you know, we are anywhere close to becoming a diverse city. And there is a table that ranks all the large cities in terms of diversity. In 2010, we used to be the very last, meaning least diverse. So we have moved up a spot, I think, about Colorado. Something I forget. but this is the composition, and we are definitely getting diverse, and I don't have a slide for that. But if you look at the same breakup for children, you know, 0 to 17 and 17 to 20 or something, the children are definitely much more diverse than adults as a group. And that certainly means, you know, we have implications for educational, institutions, and everything ties to housing, that then families with children ought to be able to live near good schools, not just any schools. So this is the last of the slides that I have before I hand it over to Bimal. This kind of shows the numeric changes and the race 2+ races, that's where we added the most number of people. And race is self-identification. So it could have been very well, you know, someone who identified as something else, choosing to do 2+, whatever it is. Bimal reminded me, like when you see the drop of 108 for American Indian Alaska Natives, though it's a full count, but traditionally, you know, all people of color have been undercounted, and particularly so, and this is true in case of the American Indian Alaska Native community. So I don't even, you know, though it sounds so precise, a drop of 108, I'm not even sure, we need to really go by that. And in the past, it's been some years, but we have tended to also make a note when we use the census provided race data, that for the Native community, we always use a community validated number. And that had been around 36,000 for the county. But this kind of lays the base for us, how we gained the 68, it's close to the 69,000 people, and what's their race. I think the next slide is on income. So I'm going to hand it over to Bimal, but I'll run the slides.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, Uma, for an excellent historical as well as recent overview of demographic changes in Portland based on recent census data. Now, what I'll do is I'll just briefly highlight just a few points to show the disparities in income, poverty level, and home ownership and rentership rates across various rates and ethnicity groups, which I think I'm hoping that this information will frame us as we move ahead with our fair housing work. So this is the first slide, shows the median house income by race and ethnicity from 2014 to 2019. And you can see that the median house income actually increased for almost all groups. But then if you dig in and look at the specific the race and ethnic groups, you see that they do vary a lot. And if you just look at the income for the whites versus the income for the Black African American, there's still a lot of disparities, even though the income has risen for all groups in general. Next slide. So this slide shows the poverty rates. Poverty rates are based on the federal poverty data. And overall from 2014 to 2019, you can see that poverty rate actually decreased for almost all groups. So, but then again, if you start looking at specific race or ethnicity group, you'll find that they do vary from each other. So certain groups has the poverty rates very high, but they have actually decreased from 2014 to 2019. One of the reason I think speculation for this decrease in poverty rate is the actually the new, the rising of the minimum wage that actually contributed to the lowering of the poverty rates. Next slide, please. So this slide shows the number of households from 2014 to 2019. And you know, the households actually increased by 6.6%. But if you look at the owner-occupied households and the renter-occupied households, they are slightly different. Owner-occupied households increased by roughly 8%, whereas the renter-occupied households increased by 6%. But what's really interesting is that if you look at the owner-occupied as well as the renter-occupied, you find that it's coming to a sort of like a parity, where it's almost like 50-50 split between the owners and the renters. So that will have implications as we go along with our building more affordable. This shows this slide shows the homeownership rates by race and ethnicity. So homeownership actually rates are actually increasing for almost all the group. You know, overall, it's increasing.
Could you speak up?
Sorry
to interrupt.
So the homeownership rates increase overall, but it also increased for almost all the groups except for the African American and Hawaiian Pacific groups. So the homeownership rates are decreasing for these particular groups. Next slide, please. So the rentership is actually different, actually flip side of the homeownership. You'll see that the rentership decreased overall, and also it decreased for almost all groups. So whereas the rentership decreased for the African American. So that these are some of the basic points I'm just trying to highlight, and assuming that this will help us frame our work as we move along and doing more about fair housing work. So our data continuation, we start still keep on collecting and analyzing data, and we are hoping to present and come up with the housing types next time, and we'll start focusing on the new analysis looking at the disability rate as well as the low income housing analysis. So at this point, I'd like to open you to the bigger group to get your guidance and suggestions and ask your colleagues to approach you with this particular question. I'm sorry, I have my voice is off.
Thank you guys. It sounds like the volume was a little bit there. I have a very loud voice, so I hope I'm not yelling at you because I am yelling in person to make sure that the mic picks me up. Thank you to Vimal and thank you to Uma for putting together that work. I don't know if you heard Vimal at the end there, but we would love to get the committee's feedback on this demographic summary. We do have more work planned to bring back. And again, this would kind of be that first section of the overall plan. And this is to provide context. I know everyone's very excited to get to policy recommendations and more the meat of the work, but we'd love to get your thoughts on this first section. Marisa, feel free to unmute.
Yeah, thank you so much for all of this information, Bimal and Uma. I just have a couple questions, or actually one thing I'll ask is, would it be easier for me to ask like multiple questions at once right now, just to kind of keep it flowing? Or should I like maybe ask a question and then wait, let somebody else go? Or just wondering for process sake.
Just ask away.
Or just ask away. Just go for it. Okay. So my first question is about the decrease in poverty. And this may have been where the sound was a little fuzzy, but it kind of sounded, Bimal, like you were saying that you were, you know, suspecting there was a relationship between the adoption of a minimum wage increase and the decrease in poverty. And I was wondering if you could say more about that, or, you know, if there are maybe like alternative explanations for that.
Definitely, Marisa. I think it actually came up in our last meeting when I presented this information to a different group. Only one part of explanation is because of the maybe rising of the minimum wage, but it definitely it also has like because of the overall the you know like pyramid of the economy was doing good, so that also made some difference. But I think it makes for like there more analysis to really figure out what are the causes.
So if I heard you right, that could be a contributing factor, but there would need to be more analysis to know what the reason is. Is that what you said? I'm sorry.
At this point, like I've just presented basically the basic fact about what the rates are, but we haven't really dug into like what are the reasons for the poverty rates to come down. But if you feel it's important to look at it as a part of our work, and we'll definitely be happy to look at it.
Okay, great.
I just wanted to add to what Bimal is telling you. So this drop you see, and you will see, you know, a companion increase in the median income, and that was actually true across the board. Meaning even at a national level, and the literature has evidence that this was before COVID hit us, towards like, you know, 2018, 2019. And it's hard to kind of point this one thing causes the effect. So it's not like the minimum, you know, the minimum wage was increased, but there was this, and it's so hard to remember because we fell on such hard times as a world. But there was this period of prosperity, which hadn't happened until way back in the 1970s. So that day, the drop in poverty is actually, it's valid across the nation and the state and the city.
That's true.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because I guess what I wanted to, maybe more to the point of my question is like, is there any possibility that you see that drop in the share of folks who are experiencing poverty because they are now elsewhere, right? So like, would it be possible that people who are experiencing poverty don't live here anymore as much because they can't afford to? I mean, I guess I just wonder if that's possible.
You know what, that would be circumstantial and certainly possible because we can map, and that could be part of the work, and we have thought about it. You know, if you map the geography of poverty, just gotten dispersed, because nothing is affordable, and even across the river, things are getting not affordable, but it's just that it'd be hard to say it's not, because you can't follow people unless it's done deliberately. Because I am inclined to think that the share of people who are in poverty has probably gone up compared to not the poverty rates themselves, but the number of people compared to the last time, but it's hard for us to tell, are these the same people or they had to move away? But I think based on what you're saying, it'll be good to kind of map this geography of poverty. And that'd be good to look at.
Yeah, I totally agree. I'm really glad you use the word map, you know, in part because I think this was some of the thoughts I had shared a while back with Nikki about the fair housing assessment. It's just that need at some point in the future to really incorporate multiple geographies or multiple jurisdictions in that analysis, just given the fact that, you know, especially when we talk about homelessness and housing instability, we know that it is so regional. It is really difficult to think about these issues and like how people are pushed out of communities, especially people of color, when we only, you know, kind of focus in on one jurisdiction. So yeah, I think that would be really interesting to look at. My other question, which I hope that I'm not taking too much time, but it's very similar in a way because, so with the slides you showed, I don't know if I absorbed this correctly because it's just kind of, you know, going quickly and I didn't have a chance to look at it beforehand. But one of the things that I thought I saw on there was a decrease in Native American rentership. And so again, you know, one of the things we see a lot in homelessness is just like really significant racial disparities for Black households and for Native American households, who are much more likely to experience homelessness, not only in this area in Portland, Multnomah County, but also all across Oregon. So I'm just wondering if you could say more about that decrease in rentership and whether that also tells us something about a displacement type of situation for Native American households.
Yeah, I think it's duly noted. I think we don't just look at this from like the city of Portland perspective. We haven't completely dug into like the deal of some sort of I think it needs more for the work to be able to analyze like what are the reasons for the rentership decreasing. Is it because of a better provision of affordable housing programs specifically meant for Native Americans? I'm not sure. Yeah. So I think it just takes more looking.
And Marisa, actually, and we'll keep this in mind because 2021, they did the point of, was 22, they did the point in time count. Right. And later this summer, they're going to release detailed, you know, demographics on the unsheltered people experiencing unsheltered homelessness. And it'd be good to see where that stands, though it cannot, it's not like one is directly, you can draw a line, but that is definitely, you know, connecting the two would be helpful. And we could say, you know, have we seen some dramatic increase in the Native population becoming homeless or something. Very good point. We will definitely keep this in mind.
Just a side note, Vimal, I'm getting feedback that they still can't hear you very well, so we're going to try to turn off the fan and project Vimal. I'll hand it back to Marisa. I didn't know if you had another question or comment there.
Yeah, thank you again so much, Uman Bimal. My last thing is more of a comment because I think it was Uma, it was you who had showed the demographic slide, I think, about age. And, you know, this question of increase in the older adult population. And so just coming from that area of focus, I would just throw out there really quickly, because I try to say this as much as I can, as far as the housing needs of older adults is, you know, a lot of times we do really focus on accessibility for disabilities, right? Like ADA and mobility and ramps and handlebars and things like that. But one of the things I know we need to also really remember is just that affordability is such a huge factor. The incredible gargantuan need for deeply affordable units for older adults who are increasingly relying on incomes that just cannot pay rent. And then also low barrier housing, you know, housing that is accessible to people who may have financial difficulties, might have experience with the carceral system because they are disproportionately impacted by it, things like that. So just throwing it out there, because I know we do always talk about, you know, ADA when it comes to older adults, but Just want to put those things out there. And thank you again.
Thank you, Marissa. I think I saw Jay's hand up for a moment. Jay, did you have
a question? Yeah, I'm sorry. I just wanted to ask some clarifying questions, but I think Marissa got to my, I lost service in the middle. One question was, because I didn't get it, was there was a last slide and all I caught was the Black population hadn't changed since the two centuries, but I could ask all of this, these questions offline. I missed a lot of it because of my my Wi-Fi lost it. So don't worry about me. That's why I put my hand down.
I'm going to send out the presentation as well. And I apologize we weren't able to get it to you too far in advance. We had some rescheduling and some other things. But that way you can digest and review and certainly send us questions, of course, or comments and feedbacks too. So when I send that out, Jay, you can check out that last slide. Mara?
Thank you so much, and hello, everybody. Thank you for the presentation. I think one thing I'm understanding more and more is that data is going to become very important, but it is hard to get the data that we need. And I think, you know, I just support everything that Marissa said because of the reality of it all. You know, it's like these numbers are important, but so that we can put them together with what we're seeing out there on the ground and hopefully figure out how to change this for folks and make a, you know, make some policy changes to try to help. Because yeah, it is, I don't know, it's fascinating to see the numbers, like the growth stuff and all of that. It really informs a lot of the direct service that I do, but it also feels very disconnected from it too. So, but yeah, but I appreciate all of that and it definitely helps put things in perspective. But I also have a lot of questions about what it means, right? Because right away when I heard that about the incomes going up, my first thought was, well, that's because people are being pushed out and people with higher incomes are moving in. That's just been my experience, you know, but you're right, without better data, it's hard to show people that that's actually what's happened. Thank you for that presentation.
Thank you for your comments, Mara. Alan? Oh, Alan, I think you're muted.
There we go. Hi, hey everybody, good to see y'all. And thanks for the presentation. I think what I would say just in general, I think Marissa touched on it, is I think because of the way we are looking at this data, especially from a fair housing perspective, the spatial connection might be important too. I think as Marissa pointed out, the piece about the change in poverty might be important spatially in what we're seeing in communities. And I think that's also true for racial demographics, to see, are we seeing certain areas of the city that are becoming more or less exclusionary or inclusionary? You know, because that will really help frame when we talk about housing choice, you know, what it means for folks, not just necessarily that the population is going up or down in the city overall, but is it going up or down in certain parts of the city relative to what, you know, the residents that may have been there in the past. So I don't know if that's a kind of in the next steps in looking at demographic or not.
Oh, Alan, it definitely is. And, you know, the whole fair housing, it's not just the numbers, but it's also about, you know, where they are living. So the whole segregation index or dissimilarity, I think it's all in the work plan. So this is, we just wanted to make sure that we establish this base with you, but you're absolutely right that we would be looking at all that.
Thank you.
Jay, your hand is back up.
Yeah, so there was some pretty high numbers that, and again, with a lack of clarity, there were some really high numbers. And I'm trying to figure out, I saw like 21% African-American and Native American, or there's maybe like a 4% decrease since the last census. I'm having a hard time understanding. Are we saying 21% of Native American or African American people are houseless of the total population of people collected in the census?
Let's give a second to for Uma to pull it up and see if you can.
Talking about the housing tenure, is it okay to call you JJ?
Yeah,
I'm not sure I could take liberty, but there you go. Let me put it up there.
There. Okay,
here
we go.
Maybe go backwards. Yeah.
So there was a slide. Here we are.
The rentership.
Okay, the rentership in the city of Portland. So this is the rentership. It's the next slide after this.
This one's home ownership.
Nope. Next. Housing tenure note next. Poverty rates by race and ethnicity. This is what we're looking at. Poverty race.
Are you talking about
the poverty rates by race and ethnicity? Yes, this is what I'm talking about here. So I'm looking at this 29%. This is what I'm looking at this 29% for Black Americans and Native Americans. These high numbers, and we're talking about of the total population that that was collected by census. This is the poverty rate.
This is the poverty rate households that they could establish the poverty rates. They calculated based upon the federal poverty, depending on the number of households.
It feels important to note that Black Americans, Black folks and Native folks, and there's not very many in Portland at all. So for us to be looking at numbers that are 29% of collected, it feels like the imbalance isn't captured because this is the whitest city in America, right? So for you to have, if something feels wrong here, and you guys know how I am, I get like sweaty and my heart starts beating fast. Something is here and I don't know what it is, so I just want to speak it into the space. Maybe somebody else is feeling this way. There's something about this slide I feel like there needs to be more added to it. There needs to be more information about like the overall demographics about Portland, unless I'm understanding this wrong.
Yeah, Jay, I fully agree with you. I mean, as a African American group and Native American group, they're always undercounted. So their portion of the whole city is smaller compared to the other groups. So maybe it looks like it's an unfair comparison, but at the same time, this is the data what we have in the census. And maybe there's a better way of presenting the information. We can look into it. A detailed explanation of where, why it's different might definitely help.
Hey, Dave. And just adding to that, and you were breaking up, so, I don't speak for Bimal, we are not fully clear on what your question is, and my guess is you are saying, you know what, was this kind of, this is a pretty substantial drop, right? Is that what you were saying, like from 42% to 29% or something? Is that what you're saying? And in which case, we will make sure these numbers are, you know, what they are, and if you can just send the question type to this, we will take a little bit more better look at it and try and explain to the best extent possible. And the one other thing, and you see, these are estimates, right? Estimates is not the same as the actual parameter. We're estimating based on a sample. So what we could do is, you know, this is the best that can be done with estimates. You can run a test of confidence that, you know, we are 95% confident that this is a true change and it's not some random number you're saying. So if in fact that's your concern, and you're right, it's a dramatic drop. We will go back and take a second look and try to address the question and concern. And if this is completely, these kind of concerns are relevant for the work around fair housing. It's like, you know what? This data says there's this big drop, but the ground truth is it is not visible in the community or something. I hope that will be acceptable for you.
Yeah, thank you so much. When Nikki sends it, I'll take a look at it and then just ask more questions offline, because I don't think I'm understanding what I'm seeing.
Okay, no worries, fair enough.
Okay, I know Bimal has a hard out with us and it is 4 p.m. And we have public testimony coming up, but I did see Mara's hand, and Uma can stay with us here, and also I can take more questions and comments specifically for Bimal as well after he leaves. So let's do Mara, and I see a couple more hands, and then maybe we can come back to this after we provide an opportunity for public testimony, just so that we respect any community members' times to get here. Mara?
I was just going to chime in and say, going back to the other thing about data, you know, again, making sure that we're using it in a way that's going to be beneficial. And so I guess when I see that number, I mean, it reinforces my understanding that there is systemic racism and that people of color, you know, while maybe poverty for them is dropping, it does still seem disproportionately high that so many people of color live in poverty, you know, even if that drop was more drastic than in the white community. I get that just feels like an important number to investigate, the fact that don't look at the drop, but more look at the percentage. And that may just be my social work brain, but that's what I see there, you know. But again, I think it's about numbers can be useful, but also I think they can be used to manipulate and control and to sort of dictate the narrative. And so that's why I like all these questions that people are asking about the data. And I love the people who gather the data. So I appreciate it.
We don't gather, we just look at it. But Mara, that was a great point. And I think because this is just the beginning, right? And I'm glad you all find it interesting. Because there is the companion piece around nothing substantiate the difference between the income potential. We just look at median household income by race. It is absolutely stunning. It's like, you know, the city is out there and you look at the African-American or Native, it's like literally half of that. So even if they made a little bit more, but it's still well below, you know, what one needs to be able to survive, that drop itself is not as meaningful, and it doesn't behoove us to just conclude, you know what, there was this 20% drop and everything is good. So point well taken. Thank you.
Thank you, Mara. That is where I was getting to, is like if the Black people in Oregon are only at 1% or 1.7% and 29% of them are living in poverty, that is huge. You know what I mean? It's a completely different than, 97% of the rest of Oregon is white, and 12% is living. You know, that, thank you, Mara. I couldn't articulate it, but it's a way bigger disparity than what we're looking at, and the joy of it dropping. Although it is a great thing that it dropped, also, it's still out of control.
Okay, Marisa and Alan, if you don't mind holding on until after public testimony, and we can circle back. Uma's not running away. I'll hold her here. It's the benefit of being in person. She can't sneak off. I will go ahead and call. We had one participant signed up for public testimony. Kim Wen, if you are on the line, feel free to unmute yourself. I don't see Kim in our participant list. And so if anyone else from the community is here and would like to provide public testimony or comment, I invite you now, go ahead and unmute or send something in the chat. Okay, all right. Thank you everyone for taking that quick pause, and we can turn right back around and I will call on Marisa for continuing comments.
Yeah, thank you. Well, you know, I'll just say, I'll express my appreciation. I'll add to the appreciation for Jay's question, because I think maybe this is just a good time to think again about, you know, that relationship between poverty and housing instability, And, you know, again, as Jay's pointing out and other folks are pointing out, we do still want to look at, you know, disproportionate poverty among communities of color, especially Native American and Black American households. And then also like where it may sort of like contradict some of our notions about like what is going on with racial disparities in housing stability and homelessness, because like the more recent data that I've seen, you know, at the statewide level would say specifically that Black Oregonians are represented in homelessness more than three times their share of the population in Oregon, and American Indian and Alaska Native Oregonians are represented more than four times their share of the Oregon population. So those are figures that feel as if they're in conflict here, and it doesn't necessarily mean that one or the other isn't correct. It's just maybe we need to think about how those two kind of like comport. And then my other piece on this is, you know, I don't think we've talked about this as much recently in this space. I know in Multnomah County, we've talked a bit about, you know, some of the work around racial disparities and homelessness and some of the research of, there was a Spark collaborative years ago that has kind of put out some research that, you know, I know folks have talked a lot about. And one of the things they talked a lot about when, you know, we were first kind of getting introduced to that work and some of like the deep, like quantitative and qualitative analysis that they were doing around race and homelessness was kind of spoke to something like this, which was, you know, where you see poverty in communities of color that are disproportionately impacted by homelessness, it isn't necessarily that there's like these extreme values of our extreme rates of poverty, and then it always equals an extreme rate of homelessness. And so my understanding as a layperson is the breakdown there is it isn't just about poverty, right? Because if it was just about poverty, then all we would have to do is end poverty, right? And we do, but I think it's also about these systemic impacts of discrimination. It's about, you know, the lack of affordable housing. It's about these systems that feed into homelessness and housing instability, like the criminal justice system, our carceral system, our health system, you know, things like that. So I guess I don't want to complicate things too much by always introducing like these multi-sector types of questions, but I think it's just so important to think about, because if we're talking about, you know, access to housing and like really making it so that we have a community that promotes fair access and what are the needs people have, then I just kind of want to bring it back to like there don't seem to be easy solutions. And often when we do kind of presume that like this one specific domain of poverty is like the thing to look at, we miss a lot of other things. So I'm sure everyone here kind of knows that, but I just want to reiterate that.
Thank you, Marisa. Alan, you had your hand up as well.
Yeah, oh, I think the points I was going to make got covered in the parts of the discussion. So thank you though.
Well, thank you again, Uma. I've made notes of everybody's feedback and questions, and I'm kind of hearing a greater need for context and care and understanding each of these points. And we will be bringing more back to you, as Bimal noted, in our next fall meeting scheduled for October. And then we're going to be digging in deeper as we get into disparate means and low-income household analysis, dissimilarity index, and all those other things that we sent out in the plan. And I'll go ahead and send that memo, that project plan memo, again, now that we have gotten our foot into the first section of work. I'll send it along with the slides as well so that you can keep that in mind with what you're looking at.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Okay, so I will go ahead and move us to our next agenda item, and we might be able to wrap up as we didn't have too much public testimony, but it's very important that we talk once again about our subcommittees, which we've been talking about since the beginning of this year. And so back at our last meeting in April, we got a clear picture of the subcommittees that folks were most interested in, and we got some light commitments. I went ahead and sent out a poll to make sure that we would have enough interest to sustain that creation. And we did. So right now we have the community engagement subcommittee, as well as the policy and best practices subcommittees that would like to meet on a more than quarterly schedule and dig into some of this work. However, in order to get those moving, we do need FPAC, all of you, to formally vote and create them. And so Jay is going to assist us through this process as well, because we haven't taken a vote before. I'll quickly kind of go over what that looks like. We need someone to make a motion to create the subcommittee. We will need another committee member to volunteer to second that motion. And then we'll go through who is here and ask for a vote, yay or nay, in order to the vote to pass and the subcommittee to be created. We need 9 yays.
All right. So it's Jay again. I motion to create a community engagement subcommittee. Is there a second?
I'll second. Oh, sorry.
Perfect. Love it. Okay. So from there, I will go ahead and read off who is here. Please unmute and vote yay or nay on Jay's motion to create a community engagement subcommittee. Ashley Miller.
Yay.
Rachel Nessie.
Yay.
Taylor Smiley Wolf.
Yay.
Alan Lazo.
Yay.
Barbara Geyer.
Yay.
Barbara. Yung Ho.
Yay.
Yeah. Ellen Tolan.
Yay.
Thanks, Ellen. Jamila Rutherford.
Yay. Oh, wait, do I get the vote?
Yeah.
If I made the motion?
Yeah, even though you
okay.
Marisa Espinosa.
Yay.
Fanny Adams.
Yay.
Okay, that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10 yays. So officially have created our community engagement subcommittee.
Yay.
Yay.
All right, so I motion to create a policy and best practice committee subcommittee. Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you, Marisa. Okay, you guys ready to do it again? Love it. Okay, Ashley Miller.
Yay.
Rachel Nessie.
Yay.
Taylor Smiley Wolf.
Aye.
Alan Lazo.
Yay.
Barbara Geyer.
Yay.
Yung Ho.
Yay.
Ellen Toland.
Yay.
Jamila Rutherford.
Yay.
Marisa Espinosa.
Yay.
Fanny Adams.
Yay.
Okay, that is another 10 votes in favor to officially create the policies and best practices subcommittee. Yay.
This is Mara. Yay. I give my yay on that second one, but I'm just putting it out there. I didn't hear my name called.
Oh, did I not call you? Sorry, Mara. Gotcha. Okay.
I'm a fan of rules of order anyway, but I do put this.
Sorry, I think maybe I didn't have you on my attendance list from the beginning. My bad. Apologies. Okay. So with that, I will go ahead and send out that information to everybody who signed up. I did have a couple folks that signed up who will not be reappointed after the end of their term. And I also had a couple folks that responded yes, but they didn't enter their name into the form. So I have a couple mystery participants. So I'm just gonna read out who I currently have signed up. And if I missed you, please go ahead and unmute and let me know. For the Community Engagement Subcommittee, I have Mara, Ellen, and Barbara. Is there anybody else who would like to participate in the Community Engagement Subcommittee whose name I did not call? Or if you are not able to respond to the poll, now would be fine. Okay, great. Mara, Ellen, and Barbara, I'll reach out to you about scheduling that. And for the Policy and Best Practices Subcommittee, I have Alan, Taylor, Barbara, and one unnamed committee member.
Probably Jay.
All right, so I've got Alan, Taylor, Barbara, and Jay. Okay, wonderful. I will go ahead and reach out to you guys and we will get that scheduled as well. Thank you. I think that's everything that we have on the agenda. I don't know if any committee members, our chair, our vice chair, have any other business that they would like to include on today's meeting.
I'd like to say thank you to Marissa for serving as chair, and you will be missed.
Thank you so much, Jay. Thank you, everyone on the committee. You're all doing such important work, and I'll miss you all.
Looks like Mara, you have your hand raised. Oh, Mara put her hand down. Okay, all right. Well, I will follow up with the items that we discussed today with the presentation, the project memo, and setting up those meetings. And other than that, I think we can go ahead and end today's meeting early. Thank you so much, everyone. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Bye.